Fly Fishing Internet Radio, your source for learning more about fly fishing in cold water, warm water, and salt water. Hello, I'm Roger Maves, your host for tonight's show. On this broadcast, we'll be featuring Kirk Webb, and he'll be answering your most important questions on fishing the lower Colorado River for trout and carp. This show will be 90 minutes in length, and we're broadcasting live over the Internet. If you'd like to ask Kirk a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. And while you're there, make sure to sign up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Just fill in your name and email address in the form on our homepage, and we'll keep you informed. This broadcast is being recorded and will be available for playback on our website within about 48 hours after the show ends. If you have to leave early, you can return to our website at your convenience and listen to the broadcast at any time. The content of this broadcast is copyrighted and is the property of the Knowledge Group, Inc., doing business as Ask About Fly Fishing. Recordings or transcriptions of this program cannot be distributed or sold in any form. When we return, we'll be talking with Kirk Webb about fishing the lower Colorado River. Front Range Anglers, a full-service fly shop located in Boulder, Colorado, provides premium tackle and comprehensive instruction and guide services to fly fishers across the country. In business for over 31 years and with a staff that averages 20 years of experience, they will give you the straight story on gear, places to fish, flies, and techniques. They publish a monthly newsletter that is one of the most informative and insightful electronic magazines in the industry. Find out more about this premier shop by logging onto their website at frontrangeanglers.com. That's frontrangeanglers.com. Before we introduce Kirk, we'd like to let you know about some of the great gifts we're going to give away tonight. For our drawing tonight, we'll be giving away a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and a one-year subscription to Fly Fishing and Tying Journal. So you have two chances to win tonight in our drawing. Now, if you haven't registered yet for the drawing, you can do so now. Just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and look for the link under Kirk's section that says click here to register for our drawing. Just click on that link, fill out the form, and we'll announce the winners at the end of the show. We'll also be giving away a dozen of Kirk's favorite flies for the Colorado River, courtesy of Taylor Creek Fly Shop. So here's how you can win. You must be the first person to answer the question we ask at the end of the show. Question will be about something we talked about during the show, and you must submit your answer along with your name and location using the text box on our homepage. So listen closely and use your best typing skills, and maybe you'll win that dozen of Kirk's favorite flies. Tonight our guest is Kirk Webb. Kirk's gift of fly fishing was given to him by his father at the age of 8 when he then received a fly tying kit under the Christmas tree that winter. Moving from the shores of Lake Michigan to the Front Range of Colorado 4 years later, Kirk immersed himself into the world of fly fishing where his life was forever changed. His first job was in a fly shop when he was 16 years old, and Kirk has successfully stayed in the industry ever since, never working a real job, and has fished his life away happily ever since. Kirk credits his undying love of the sport by having many great mentors along the way, leading him in his path of love, family life, and fishing in that order, including Tim Hang, Roy Palm, and Frank Moore. Kirk has worked at the Taylor Creek Fly Shop in Basalt since 2002, where he most enjoys fishing with his 11-year-old daughter, Madison. Well, Kirk, welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio.
Thanks, Roger. I appreciate you having me on here today.
Yeah. Well, we're trying to kind of finish up that area of Colorado. We've talked, and your shop's right smack dab in the middle of it all. You know, we talked with Tim Hang about the roaring fork and the frying pan, and now we got one more leg to do here, I think. We'll do that tonight, yeah.
We've just about got them all by now.
Yeah, so if anybody wants to go to that area, they will be all set as far as Ask About Fly Fishing shows to get them oriented. And, of course, you know, with Taylor Creek Fly Shop right smack in the middle of things, they know where to go to get help when they get out there, so. Well, good. Well, this is a little bit different, this show, because we usually end up talking about a piece of water, and usually it's occupied by one kind of, you know, fish or another, you know, either trout or bass or carp or pike or whatever. But tonight we're going to be talking about two different types of fish that live in the what we're calling the lower Colorado or below Glenwood Springs, Colorado. So we'll kind of be mixing that up tonight. We'll try to keep you straight on it, but a lot to learn, a lot to talk about. So, Kirk, let's we do have an international audience, and not everybody knows, you know, the places that we talk about. So can you kind of describe, you know, where we're talking about this part? Because the Colorado River runs from Colorado all the way down to the Gulf of California. So
right.
You want to talk about and kind of orient people as to what we're talking about tonight?
Yeah, essentially here in Colorado, we divide the Colorado River within our state of Colorado into three sections, essentially upper, middle, and lower. The upper river, we consider from its headwaters in Rocky Mountain National Park all the way down to the middle part of Colorado in and around Kremlin, Colorado, which is where we consider the middle river, and the lower river, which we call anything from Glenwood Springs going west to the state line towards Grand Junction.
Okay. Now, we and the river is starting to change character there a little bit. Just before Glenwood, it's pretty kind of a rough river section there through the canyon, right?
No, you're absolutely right. And, you know, Glenwood Canyon obviously was carved out by the Colorado River 550 million years ago. And, you know, that river obviously slices its way through that gorge. There are over 4,000 square miles of river that drain into the Colorado River above Glenwood Canyon. So we're talking about a fair amount of water, especially out here in Colorado, where I think most anglers typically fish much smaller, more intimate water, which I think is always been kind of one of the allures for me of the Colorado, if you will, is that its size can be intimidating, to say the least, to most fly fishers especially.
Mm-hmm. So, and then right there at Glenwood, where we're going to start, comes in the Roaring Fork, right, which is a pretty substantial river itself.
Yes.
Feeding the Colorado, right?
It certainly is. And obviously, I think most well-versed fly fishers especially are very in tune with the Roaring Fork, and the Colorado should be no exception. You know, I think, again, because of the size and the nature of the Colorado, it's much more underfished in comparison to the Roaring Fork, despite its great proximity running right through downtown Glenwood Springs and along I-70 with an abundance of public access.
Yeah, easy to get to, that's for sure. So let's kind of take a drift, so to speak, down the river.
Absolutely.
And, well, first of all, a question came in from Roy Fukushima in Orange, California. He said carp fishing has really taken off in Southern California in local rivers and lakes. And by the way, Roy, next week we are doing a show on carp fishing in Southern California. So what timing for your comment. But Roy wants to know, are you waiting or fishing from the boat for most of the sections we're going to be talking about, or is it going to vary from section to section?
You know what? Because of the abundance of public water that we have on the Colorado west of Glenwood Springs, wading anglers can certainly do as much, if not even more fishing, than what the float fishing angler can do. You know, both options are very good, personally. I do a lot of both. I kind of casually joke when I say that I always prefer to hop in the drift boat and float the river when the float fishing's good. And when the float fishing is not any good, I prefer to wade fish. And the wade fishing is always typically very good. So realistically, either way you go, it's still all about the fish. It's all about chasing that carp. You can certainly do it from a boat. You can certainly do it from on foot as well.
Okay, so there's plenty of access through the sections we're talking about for wade fishermen that don't have boats to get in there and mix it up, right?
There is, most definitely.
Okay. So let's take in that drift down the river. First of all, we're going to start out, what, in Glenwood Springs?
Yeah, we can start out just above Glenwood Springs, as we talked about a little bit previously here in Glenwood Canyon. Glenwood Canyon is kind of a a unique stretch of river, even within the short 40 to 50 mile stretch of river that we're talking about on this program. It's roughly just over 5 miles in length, and there's a great bike path that runs throughout its entire length. Public access is there throughout its entirety. Anywhere along the bike path there, you can certainly just get out and fish. And, you know, it's actually one of my more fun things to do is to grab my mountain bike. I can even grab my daughter, and we can hit the trail on the mountain bike and kind of parallel up the river through Glenwood Canyon. And it's certainly a lot of fun. The water up there is, obviously, since it's in a canyon, it is a little bit more narrow. The water has more structure in the way of rocks and riprap and that type of thing compared to, we'll say, Glenwood Springs going west, where the river certainly widens, flattens out, calms out more. And then as we eventually make our way down below Newcastle to Silt and Rifle, the river kind of takes on another character as well, turning more into that warm water fishery. You know, right in and around that Rifle area is kind of where the trout cease to exist and where those other warm water species like carp start to begin.
Okay. So that's kind of a high-level view or tour of the river. So rewinding back up into the canyon, let's talk about that stretch there. Now, how long is that stretch, would you say, that's fishable there?
Oh, that stretch of river is probably like 5 to 7 miles in length, something like that. It's certainly a huge piece of water.
Now, is that floatable in rafts or drift boat, or does it make more sense to fish that from shore?
It is floatable. We do float the western edge of the canyon, and the float fishing is very good. I will say it is a very popular place for what we kind of call the splashing giggles or the rubber boat hatch. It's a very popular location for whitewater rafters. Because of that, it doesn't necessarily get a lot of attention from the fishing community just due to the boat traffic, at least in the high peak times of year of June, July, and August. But beyond those times, it certainly float fishes great and is probably one of the most scenic floats not only in Colorado, but I think in anywhere in North America. It is a drop-dead gorgeous float going through Glenwood Canyon.
So where would you put in, then? Where's the boat ramp that you normally put in?
The boat ramp that most of us use, again, this is more drift boat and fishing-oriented here, but it's going to be at Grizzly Creek, which is just about 4 miles outside of Glenwood Springs to the east on I-70.
Okay.
And we can float that down to Glenwood Springs, which is a nice short half-day float of about 5 to 6 miles.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And then where's your takeout there, which I assume is our next put-in as well, right?
Yeah, our next takeout there in Glenwood Springs is called Two Rivers Boat Ramp, which sits just downstream of the confluence of the Roaring Fork of the Colorado, but just a couple hundred yards.
Is that river right or left, south
that
side?
That would be on river right.
Okay. So is there, it looks like there's like a park there or something. I see some green on the map there.
Yeah, there is. There's a beautiful downtown park, a dog walk park, a baseball field, and it's actually kind of an interesting little side story. You know, sometimes they kind of turn on those big floodlights at night over there in the summertime to highlight some of the baseball and softball games that goes on. And, you know, it also makes for a lot of illumination out there on the river neighboring the baseball field, and it attracts all kinds of insects, too. So we can even, or I've even in the past, have done a lot of night fishing even on the Colorado in the summertime down there where the lights obviously attract caddis and other sorts of mayflies and spinners and things of that nature.
Yeah, cool. So then, now, in that first section, in the canyon stuff, is it primarily trout? And
it is. We do have the most popular species, certainly the rainbow trout and the brown trout. It's maybe, I'd say, about a 50-50 mix of rainbows and browns in Glenwood Canyon, where the further we drift west and the water continues to warm, we'll kind of see that brown trout population increase and the rainbow trout population slowly subside. But in addition to the rainbows and the browns, there are a handful of brook trout as well as our native fish, our native trout, the Colorado River cutthroat, as well as whitefish and suckers and other species.
Those
we kind of have it all.
Yeah. It's funny, you know, whitefish, like up on the Bighorn in Montana, they had a lot of whitefish.
Yeah.
And I never minded them because those always went in my cooler to be smoked later.
You're darn right. I agree with you.
Yeah, clean up the river a little bit and make for some nice smoked whitefish, you know.
That's right.
Make some room for trout, yeah.
So, in addition, I think some of the biggest whitefish to be found in Colorado certainly are along the bottom portion of the Roaring Fork at Glenwood Springs, as well as the Colorado River itself in Glenwood Springs. The state record in whitefish actually came out of the Roaring Fork.
Oh, really? I didn't know that.
Almost a 6-pound whitefish.
That's not a bad fish, is it? I don't care what kind of fish it is.
Yeah, they pull like that. Anything that pulls is good in my book.
Yeah, there you go. Okay, now, I'll throw this question in from DB in Escondido, California. He says, the area along I-70 from Glenwood Springs to Grand Junction just always looked like there was not much ability to walk the riverbank and be able to be successful. Much of it appears to be private land. Am I wrong on this?
Yes and no. It is interspersed, private and public. I will say you do have to do your homework to make sure that you're not trespassing or going someplace where you shouldn't be. You can certainly check on Forest Service maps or Nat Geo type maps, as well as there's some very good river access maps that are available for purchase online as well, that will highlight those specific public areas in addition to put-ins, takeouts. You know, obviously, they can always just call us at Taylor Creek Fly Shop, and we'd be more than happy to send out one of those access maps as well.
Yeah. Now, do they, if you're floating the river, is it pretty well marked because that's the private water when you get there?
It is not. That's a great question.
Oh, okay.
Right. There is not a lot marked on the lower Colorado River. You know, we kind of meaning guides and the like, kind of dub that river, it's almost like no man's land. You know, it's still a river that has a lot of unknowns and a lot of questions. And I think that's a lot of the allure for me as well, is that no one really has this river kind of quote-unquote figured out, if you will. It's something we're all still learning from. It's a very fickle river that, you can have the best day of your life fishing one day and go back the next day and have the absolute worst day of your life and, not even see or even touch a fish. So it is very fickle, and I think because of that, it's not really, I guess you could say, for the average angler. You definitely have to put in your dues, but again, like I said, when the sun shines, it's one of the best trout fisheries, I think, to be found anywhere in the country.
Well, talking about the water rights, because in Colorado, when you have private land going up to a river, that landowner basically owns the land underneath the river, right?
They do. That's correct.
So,
absolutely.
If you're in private area, you're not supposed to, by law, and correct me if I'm wrong here, but anchor, wade, go ashore in that section, right? You're free to float through it and fish, but not stop or hang out, basically, right?
You're spot on, Roger. That's absolutely
okay.
The case. The landowner does own a stream bed in Colorado,
okay.
Like you said. So, again, that really just goes back to really doing your homework and carrying those maps with you and making sure that you're not trespassing.
Yeah. Now, in the lower Colorado there, are landowners more lenient, would you say, than maybe some of the landowners in some famous battle zones like Montana and you know, Wyoming?
Yeah. As of right now, Roger, I would say yes. I think the landowners are more lenient, and I think that's due in large part just because that section of river receives very little fishing pressure. You know,
right.
I think it's so rare that they ever see anyone float that river, much if any, or very often at all. And
yeah.
Because of that, you know, it's never really become much of an issue like it has in other places like Montana or whatnot.
Yeah, okay. So after the takeout there just below Roaring Fork, then where would our next takeout be from that?
The next one that we would have from that is going to be a couple miles downstream. It'd be a short half-day float, maybe 5 to 6 miles down to South Canyon. South Canyon is a seasonal boat ramp, though, that typically only operates spring through fall. There is another boat launch about a mile and a half to 2 miles west of South Canyon called Dino, or Tibbetts Landing, that we can also use, and that is a year-round ramp.
You said the first one was South Canyon?
South Canyon.
The creek, okay, yeah. That's outside of town then, yeah, where 134
correct.
Comes in. Yeah.
Yes.
Okay, just trying to follow it on Google Maps along with you here.
And then the next one down below that is called Dino Hole. Dino Hole is a boat ramp on River Wright. The only word of caution, I guess you could say, so to speak, that I'll throw out there about that boat ramp is that you can only access that boat ramp from the eastbound lane of I-70. If you're going westbound, you'll have to come down to Newcastle, make a U-turn, and head east again to exit at that Dino Hole takeout.
That's good to know. So let's talk about that stretch of the river now, from Glenwood down to South Canyon and Dino Hole. Still in trout water here?
Very much so. Still definitely in the hotbed of the trout water. And, you know, again, as we move away from Glenwood Springs and away from the Roaring Fork River, that river, and outside of Glenwood Canyon, that river does take on that another character, you know, and that river definitely widens, deepens. It's a river that kind of typified by having long runs, very big, slow-moving eddies, and numerous stretches of what I tend to call frog water or flat water or even lakes, if you will.
Okay.
In other words, it's not really typical trout water, I think, for most fishermen. When they're looking at that piece of water and trying to digest it, there's not really a lot of key structure elements, if you will, that most fishermen would be able to hone in on, you know, which, again, I think kind of keeps that fishing pressure away a little bit.
Yeah, you know, I've driven by there. I've never fished there. Lived in Colorado most of my life. Drove by there I don't know how many times. But, you know, never fished it because I always thought, at that point, after Glenwood, I would expect, you know, there's not going to be very many fish in there or it's getting too warm, you know, for trout, that kind of thing. And it's just kind of a naive, you know, viewpoint on it. But maybe that's what a lot of other people, they have the same viewpoint. I don't know.
No, I would totally agree.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think we always kind of, most people were thrown off, I think, a little bit by the Colorado River down here in the fact that the water is rarely clear, you know, kind of what we like to say in local fishing circles is in regards to water clarity, green is good, brown is bad, you know, and we kind of always keep that in mind in a nutshell where, you know, if that water has a greenish cast to it, even if there's only maybe a foot and a half to 2 feet of water visibility, that's still considered a green light and a go for us. You know, it's those times when that water takes on more of that brownish tint or even more of that glacier gray tint when the river is unfishable. And truthfully, you know, it is a very fickle river in terms of water clarity. You know, it can blow out very easily in the lightest of rainstorms. Again, just because of the massive numbers of feeder creeks that come into the Colorado River.
Oh, yeah, yeah. It's amazing. And that's kind of, I think we may have that more in the west than they do in the east. But, you know, I floated the Grand Canyon in the Colorado, you know, 21-day trip down there.
Yeah.
And I remember one day sitting on the rock and drinking a beer, looking down at the river. And the river was perfectly clear. It just looked great. It was beautiful. And all of a sudden, you could see this cloud in the river coming down. Just, it was almost like a Stephen King movie, you know, where this entity was in the river, just coming down and clouding the river. And you could just see it come. And it was a beautiful sunny day. And what was happening is there was some rainstorm up in some canyon up above that was, you know, bringing down all that silt and then just discolored the whole river within just minutes, you know, just like that. So. Yeah,
it's a sight that I think has to be seen, you know. It's even almost hard to describe, but you're absolutely right.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Let's take a quick break here, Kirk, and then we'll come back and talk more about the Colorado, just in and around Glenwood Springs here. Women's fly fishing in Alaska is owned and operated by well-known female guide Pudge Kleinkopf. Women's fly fishing offers several lodge-based fly fishing schools for women, as well as an array of small guided trips for women and couples to some of Alaska's best-known waters for salmon, rainbow trout, Arctic grayling, and char. Pudge also leads saltwater fly fishing groups to Mexico each spring. Beginners are welcome, and equipment is provided. Learn more about fly fishing for women at www.womensflyfishing.net. That's womensflyfishing.net. Or call Pudge directly at 907-274-7113. That's 907-274-7113. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We're talking with Kirk Webb about fishing the lower Colorado River for trout and carp. If you'd like to ask Kirk a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Kirk, at this point in the show, I was asking, you know, my guess what's going on in your fly fishing world. So tell us what's happening up over there in western Colorado.
You know, this is quite honestly my single most favorite time of year for fishing in the Roaring Fork Valley here. You know, it's kind of that weird tweener season where we're at the end of winter and kind of on the leading edge of spring, and there's, you know, kind of a 6 to 8 week period, I think, from February through March that I've kind of come to dub as that fifth fishing season. It's almost become a whole fishing season and a fishing scene in itself here in recent years. But it's just kind of that awakening, if you will, away from winter slumber. You know, we're finally seeing good numbers of midges hatching on all valley waters, and we'll start to see the first mayfly hatches of the year, our blooming olives, by the end of this month into early March on the Freestone Rivers, which would be the Roaring Fork, Colorado, and the Crystal, where the Frying Pan River here recently is all about the midge. Because that river is a tailwater fishery, we won't see those blooming olives begin to hatch up there until April and ideally more so in May. But this time of year, like I said, this fishing season is a pretty remarkable time of year, and I think, you know, most of those ski bums / fishing guys, they're all still working on the mountain and that type of thing this time of year, too. So most people in and around the Roaring Fork Valley immediately just assume, you know, Aspen and skiing and snowmass and skiing and X Games and things like that. So it leaves our rivers virtually empty at this time of year, but there's a lot of really, really great fishing to be had. And like I said, it's my single favorite time of year to fish throughout our entire year period up here.
And now you're working out of Taylor Creek Fly Shop?
That's right.
And what does the Taylor Creek Fly Shop serve, all these areas?
We do serve the entire Roaring Fork Valley from Aspen all the way down to Glenwood Springs. And again, as we continue west of Glenwood Springs on the Colorado River here, I spend a lot of time fishing it all the way down to Rifle and even all the way down to the state line in Grand Junction. People always kind of laugh at me a little bit and don't necessarily believe me when I tell them that I spend, you know, more than half of my year fishing for carp up here on the lower Colorado River, just being that I live in basalt smack dab on the, in, you know, the trout mecca of Colorado on the banks of the Roaring Fork in the Frying Pan. But there's just something special about those carp, too, that, you know, dragged me away from the trout and, you know, that whole scene and pulls me down valley, as we like to say, down to the lower Colorado.
Yeah, and as Roy said, you know, carp are hot in Southern California, so it's not only Colorado but other places that people are coming on,
you know,
with carp.
It really is. It's amazing for me as a pretty lifelong carp fisher, you know, to see the popularity of carp just explode in recent years. And,
yeah,
you know, I kind of go back and forth with this moral battle of, you know, publicizing how great our carp fishing is up here, because I know all of our, a lot of my friends and guides kind of shun it when I talk about it, just because it's been such a good, well-kept secret for so long. But, you know, realistically in this day and age, I really do feel that carp fishing is becoming, you know, that hot, new, fun fish in somewhat unexplored territory in fly fishing. And,
right.
You know, that's always been part of the allure for me of that carp fishing, is getting into those unknowns and, you know, trying to solve all these riddles in fly fishing that might not necessarily have been answered yet.
Right, right. Well, let's get back in there. You're kind of leading us in there, but I want to make sure you give us the website for Taylor Creek Fly Shop before we move on. So what is their
Most
website
definitely.
Address?
You can always reach us at www.taylor, T-A-Y-L-O-R, Creek, C-R-E-E-K.com. And great, fun website, too. And I think the highlight, at least for me anyhow, is our fishing reports on there. If you want the latest and greatest information on fishing in the Roaring Fork Valley, there's no doubt that's where you're going to find it.
Okay, great, great. Well, there you go, folks. And remember, you may have heard it here first on carp fishing in the Colorado Rivers. Well, the secret's out now, Kirk. The secret's out. It's all done. So.
Hey, all good secrets come out at some point.
Let's talk. You had mentioned seasons and your fifth season, which Hutch and Basalt had asked about. I figure Hutch is somebody you know. Is he a buddy of yours? Or
Hutch Hutchison is a great dear friend of mine and actually a fairly well-known guy in the fly fishing industry. Hutch is our local Orvis rep in the Colorado Rockies and on west even to California.
Oh, okay. Good. Well, he had asked about the fifth season, and you already answered that question, but we'll give him credit for asking. And we do have some other questions about seasonal questions, and since you brought that up, maybe we can kind of dive into that a little bit at this point. Joe in Houston, Texas said, if you could only fish the lower Colorado 1 month of the year, when would that be? And then he asked about flies. We'll talk about flies later. But And would that be different for trout versus carp as to picking 1 month of the year that would be best?
You know, I think it does a little bit. Obviously, the carp fishing, and we still live in the mountains, or at least the high plains out here, you know, so the best carp fishing is certainly to be had in the warmer months. You know, I'd say March all the way through September, sometimes on a good year, even into October, where the trout fishing really is best year-round. Certainly one of the reasons I chose to live in Colorado and the Roaring Fork Valley specifically is because of our abundance of quality year-round fishing and just the sheer diversity of all the waters that we have in the immediate vicinity.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But
so
I'd say, you know, again, to kind of touch back on that, if I had to pick a month or that type of thing, I think for trout fishing, it's really almost a personal question in the way of what type of fishing do you prefer to do? You know, for the streamer junkie, you know, certainly the fall months of October and November are the creme de la creme. I think the best mayfly hatches on the Colorado are typically short-lived, but in the summertime and generally consist of green drakes, which are an evening hatch on that river, as well as midday hatches of PMDs. And I think probably one of the most popular times of year for the dry fly fishermen is the caddis hatch, our Mother's Day caddis hatch, or Brachycentrus caddis, hatches very heavily. We'll even begin to see those caddis hatch in some years at the end of March due to its lower elevation down here on the lower Colorado, but really all the way through April. We're in most fisheries, it's in more of a May-type deal. So the Colorado River, because of that lower elevation, we always see those first hatches of insects appear on that river as they gradually work their way upstream to warmer waters as the year goes on, and those insects just climb up in elevation and continue to hatch.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Again, for me personally, I really like this season. February and March are my absolute favorite time of year to trout fish on the Colorado River. It's as we touched on a little about there, it's a very overlooked time of year. I'm very much a dedicated dry fly fisherman when I can, and that fifth season also brings in those first good heavy midge hatches. And at times, those midges will hatch in just such huge, profuse numbers that they'll clump and ball together on the side of the riverbanks. And it's really a sight to be seen, and seemingly almost every fish in the Colorado River is up eating such a tiny fly in such a huge, big river. It's, for me, one of the ultimate challenges in not only just dry fly fishing for the fly fishermen, but I think light tackle angling, period.
What are, in the sections of rivers that we talked about so far, we've got Rainbow and we've got the Browns. What's the average size fish in these sections, and what would be a trophy, that you'd call a trophy in those sections?
Yeah, the average size rainbow trout that we catch on the Colorado is somewhere in the neighborhood of 14 to 18 inches. A true trophy is obviously anything over 18 inches, but we do see specimens of fish that will go up to, 25, 26, even pushing 28 inches at times. But I'd say they typically top out at about that point. Brown trout, your average-sized brown trout is probably a little bit less, somewhere in the neighborhood of the 10 to 14-inch range. But we do catch brown trout of 5 to 10 pounds out of the Colorado River every year. And I think it should also be noted that our fly shop in particular puts out just a tremendous number of float trips, and our guide staff is just top of the line, some of the best guys in the industry. So I always get all this little feedback at the end of their days every year, and, there's always that once or twice a year, oh, crap fish that people can only guess at how big it was that broke you off.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's what I was thinking, you're working with a big river. There's a lot of hiding spots, and I was thinking there's got to be some big fish in there that don't get touched much at all just because of, like you say, the lack of traffic on the river and attention that it's given. So,
I've always kind of felt, Roger, that fish that grow up in a big water environment, a harsh environment, it's not an easy life for them in the Colorado River, with all the ups and downs and environmental issues that every river has. But, I think those fish that grow up in that big water like that just have more spunk, more zest, more life to them, if you will. Just a harder fighting fish, and I think that's just because they grow up in that harsher environment.
Another kind of general question about all this water is, are there any special permits other than a Colorado fishing license that you need to access any of this water?
No, there is not. Just a Colorado fishing license.
Okay, good. Okay, so let's talk then, moving further downriver, where would be the next major access point or take out or put in?
The next one we would have below Dino, Roger, would be the Newcastle boat ramp, which sits just downstream of the Newcastle and I-70 bridge. This is a ramp that would be on river left, and it is one of the most popular put-ins along the entire Colorado River, either from anglers doing a a long trip, you know, from Two Rivers boat ramp in Glenwood down to Newcastle, or also for anglers putting in at Newcastle and floating down to the next takeout, which is in Silt, a distance of maybe about 10 miles.
Okay. Are we still in trout water at this point, or are we moving into carp water?
You know, this stretch of water from Newcastle to Silt is kind of where we get that graduation, if you will, from trout into more of those exotic species like the carp and the suckers and the chubs and whitefish and things of that nature. So you kind of have a good wash of both in that section from Newcastle to Silt. But certainly when we get to Silt and Rifle heading west, it all turns into those warm water species and the trout dissipate.
And are there any other we consider sport fish other than carp in there? Are there any smallmouth, anything like that, warm water?
Yeah, in the way of quote-unquote invasive species in the lower Colorado River, there are both smallmouth and largemouth bass. In addition to northern pike, those are kind of the big three game fish, if you will. Their numbers are certainly in big receding numbers now as the Colorado Parks and Wildlife has started to shock and transplant a lot of these invasive species out of the Colorado River and into other still waters not connected to the river. So certainly, each and every year we're seeing less and less of these invasive species, but, you know, as we all know, it's certainly a tough uphill battle in dealing with those threats.
And I noticed just above Silt, the river starts to get really braided down there. A lot of little channels and islands and so forth. So it kind of changes character there as well, too, doesn't it?
It does. You know, again, like what we discussed earlier, you know, certainly the further we move west, the wider and flatter that river becomes. And along with that, like you alluded to, there's going to be much more in the way of numerous braids and side channels. But in addition, the river bottom also takes on a little bit more of a different character where it's more of a silt-oriented bottom instead of a rocky oriented bottom. And I think it should also be noted that by the time that we get west of Silt and Rifle here, that water is typically discolored, I'd say, about a good 60 to 70% of the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Starts to muddy up after that.
Yeah, it's anything but your typical trout stream at that point.
Right. Okay, let's take another quick break, and then we'll come back and talk a little bit about equipment and maybe some flies and stuff and dig in some techniques and strategies. So be right back with you. Keeney's Fly Shop in Sacramento, California, features classes on all aspects of fly fishing. They have an extensive inventory and fly tying department. They have friendly, experienced staff whose primary goal is your complete satisfaction. Among their many services, one can book private waters or take advantage of their international travel service. Visit their extensive website at www.keeney.com. That's K-I-E-N-E.com, keeney.com. Or call their fly shop at 1-800-400-0359. That's 1-800-400-0359. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We're talking with Kirk Webb about fishing the lower Colorado River for trout and carp. If you'd like to ask Kirk a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Well, Kirk, a few questions about equipment that you'd recommend there. Roy Fukushima in Orange, California, wanted to know what weight rods and types of fly line you recommend to bring down there to the Colorado. I guess assuming that we'd be fishing trout and carp. So.
Sure. For the trout fishing, I typically carry, you know, at least two rods with me. I'd say for most of your fishing, a 9-foot, 5-weight, medium to medium fast action fly rod will certainly fill the bill. As we fish larger terrestrial insects like big hoppers or big streamers in the fall, we do go to a heavier rod, and typically I fish a softer action 6-weight generally. And this is for trout. For the carp fishing, for at least the carp fishing that we have here on the lower Colorado River, the average carp is in the neighborhood of 5 to 15 pounds. And for most of the flies that we fish and the tippets that we fish, I prefer a 9-foot 7-weight in a medium action to a medium heavy action.
Okay, okay. And what about fly lines? Primarily floating, is there any need for any sinking or sinking tip lines in the river?
Yeah, great question, Roger. I think for 99% of the trout fishing applications that we do on the Colorado River, for trout, a floating fly line is sufficient. It's a matter of personal taste as to what specific fly line, obviously whatever casts best for you with your rod. And again, personally, I like higher vis colors of a fly line for myself, just something that stands out in kind of that more off-colored type water. And personally, I like more of a long belly type fly line myself, just because they roll cast so well. In addition, if you have to make a very long cast, they have the ability to do that as well. And that also goes the exact same for a favorite carp fly line as well. I think a lot of carp fishermen, want that more subdued type line in like an olive tint or a gray tint. But for myself, I find it's more beneficial to have a more typical fly line that's yellow, green, orange. In my eyes, that's kind of the point in having the leader, having that invisible piece off of your fly line. So I never get too hung up on fly line color for carp or even trout, really, for that matter. I think it's personal preference, and personally, I like those long-bellied lines that are, in those brighter tones.
We got a question in here on the Internet from Luke in Allentown. He says, in marginal waters, do you prefer a line with a warm water coating or a cold water coating?
I think for most applications, a cold water coating would suffice. I'd much rather have a line that would be too limp rather than too stiff. Again, we live in Colorado. Our temperature swings can be very wild, and because of that, I think more of a cold water line typically works best. That being the case, if I'm specifically targeting carp on a sunny day in July or August and it's, 95 to 100 degrees out, yes, most definitely a warm water with a specific line that has obviously a stiffer core would be better used.
What about, rigging up your terminal tackle, trout versus carp? Pretty conventional on the trout, I would suppose, but the carp, do you have a different approach with how you rig up?
I'd say even a lot of our tactics that we use for trout, I wouldn't even say are necessarily conventional. By that, I think the most popular technique on the Colorado, at least to get into numbers of fish, is a 90-degree nymph rig, which is essentially an indicator that utilizes, in place of a leader, just a long piece of tippet, which kind of helps drive your fly immediately down to the bottom and in the strike zone instead of waiting for that tapered leader to kind of drift and flutter and eventually make its way down into the strike zone. It really puts those flies in that specific part of the water column in a very short period of time, thus resulting in more hookups and just being able to cover water more effectively.
Describe that very specifically from the end of your fly line down to your fly. What would the segments look like?
Yeah, at the end of my fly line, I always have about a foot-long piece of butt section, just a heavy, stiff piece of monofilament or fluorocarbon, at which the end of that foot-long piece, I would knot a thingamabobber or another type of strike indicator directly to that butt section. We haven't even tied on the leader yet. The leader is omitted in lieu of tippet. We'll take two or three series of tippet. I'll take maybe another piece of, we'll say, 2 to 3 feet of OX size tippet tied or looped in to that thingamabobber indicator. thus creating a 90-degree angle from our fly line to our indicator to our tippet. At the end of that little piece of tippet that we added, you know, I'll gradually taper it down with a piece of 2X about 2 feet in length. And then for the piece of tippet that is attached directly to the fly, that length will dictate a little bit, just depending on the depth of the water we're fishing, anywhere from 2 to 4 feet on average.
Okay.
You know, it should be noted a little bit here, Roger, that most of the fish on the Colorado hold very close and near to the banks. Because of that, we don't have to cast a million miles. Even for wading anglers, you know, oftentimes you're almost at the advantage because you have the fish right there in front of you. We're even float fishermen. We typically fish more or float more in the middle of the river, casting towards the banks, not so much on the banks, casting toward the middle of the river.
What do you usually rig up with two or more flies, or?
Great question. Typically, I rig up with two nymphs, you know, obviously depending wildly upon time of year as to what nymphs that we have on. In Colorado, you are allowed to fish up to three flies on one given line. Personally, I always try and use two. It's just a little bit easier for me to cast, a little easier in the way of line management and tangles and things like that. But, you know, I think every fisherman at some point in their career has that desperate times for desperate matters. And when I reach those points, yeah, I'm not bashful to put on three.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What about hopper dropper kinds of rigs for, you know, August, September? Is that a workable situation on the Colorado?
Yeah, very much so. The best terrestrial fishing that we have in the Roaring Fork Valley takes place on the Colorado River. And I think really that's due in large part just from all the surrounding agriculture and hay fields and things like that that are just prime territories for, like you said, grasshoppers and beetles and ants and, you know, all those other miscellaneous terrestrials. I think more often than not we'll fish a big hopper pattern more as an indicator, and again, like you said, going more like hopper dropper or hopper dropper dropper, but really we're using that hopper more as an indicator more than we are an actual fish catching pattern. But obviously there are times when you have a strong wind that'll blow hoppers off the fields onto the river, or one of my favorites are when the farmers mow all their hay fields at the beginning of fall, and you know, kind of creates swarms of grasshoppers at times.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, what you mentioned some of the, I believe you mentioned the primary hatches. You had the caddis, you had the midge, you had the mayfly. I think pale morning dun was another one, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Did we cover most of the major hatches with those, would you say?
In addition to those, certainly stoneflies of a wide variety of species. We do have salmon flies in the Colorado River. I can't say we have a huge hatch of salmon flies like you would on upstream portions of the Colorado River, like in and around Gore Canyon, for example. But we do have limited numbers of decent salmon fly hatchings that exist, mostly in Glenwood Canyon. And again, that's just because it's more suitable stonefly water. It's more of that rich, highly oxygenated, faster pocket water type water. But, you know, as we move west away from Glenwood Springs, certainly one of the heaviest hatches that we have throughout the entire year on the lower Colorado is our yellow Sally hatches, which are the small yellow golden stoneflies in that 14 to 16 size range. And like you said, that's typically more of a August type situation, and those hatches are a lot of great fun.
What about other food sources in the river?
Speckled bait, you know, I think would be the big one, at least in the way of bait fish and that type of thing. Certainly sculpins in addition to the speckled bait. But we do have some kind of unique hatches that take place on the Colorado River, including an Epioris hatch, which is also kind of known as like a pink Cahill or a pink Lady or a pink Hendrickson. But You know, this Epiorus hatch kind of hatches in the middle of the summer in the midday when nothing else is out and about. It actually provides a huge part of the fish's diet throughout those summertime months and can give you some limited but good dry fly fishing opportunities and certainly great nymph fishing opportunities.
Mm-hmm. And then you had mentioned, you know, streamer fishing earlier. How's that? Is that, you said, a more of a fall activity, would you say, for streamer fishing, or is that all year round as well?
Well, I'd certainly say the most popular time of year for most persons to streamer fish is certainly in the fall. Obviously, the brown trout are, you know, hyper-aggressive at that time of year with spawning rituals becoming to get underway. And the fall streamer fishing is, you know, epic at times, you know, on the Colorado, especially in August. And my favorite month is actually November. But that is one of those times of year when you can use a sink tip fly line, which we didn't talk about earlier, just like a teeny 200 or a teeny 250, something along those lines, to pull some of those bigger articulated and jointed streamers that are wildly popular these days, all of the Gallup creations and whatnot. I think my favorite fall streamer, though, on the Colorado River is certainly the Autumn Splendor, which is a local streamer pattern invented by Tim Henn.
Oh, by Tim. Good. Yeah. The and that's for sure, folks, if you haven't listened to our other shows on the you know, the Roaring Fork and the Frying Pan, they were both done by Tim Heng, H-E-N-G. So you can look those up in the archive and pick up on those as well. Now, what about kind of moving in here to strategies and tactics, but maybe still mixing in some flies here and so forth? Streamer fishing, how do you normally fish streamers in the fall then? Do you hit the banks, drift and hit the banks down as you move down the river? Is that a common tactic? Or?
I'd say our most common approach, Roger, is typically, you know, well, let me backtrack a little bit. The best way to streamer fish the river is certainly by float fishing, where you can cover X amount of miles of river versus obviously a spot here and a spot there like you can wade fishing. That being the case, out of a drift boat, you're correct. We typically throw our streamer at the bank. I typically like to do 1 to 2 strips, maybe 2 to 3 foot long strips, just to initially get that streamer off the bank and onto that first shelf along the river where we have that transition line from shallower water to deeper water. Once I get that streamer on the shelf, we'll kind of let it sit there and flutter, you know, anywhere from, you know, a second to 10 seconds, depending on the depth of the water, just to get that streamer down and in the strike zone a little bit further, where we then use our rod to twitch the fly out using our rod tip, not by stripping in fly line. So again, we're kind of throwing that fly at the bank, making a strip or two to get that fly onto the shelf. We're going to let it flutter and bump down a little bit. We're going to shake it out with our rod tip using very short little bumps, if you will, with our rod tip, where all we're doing with our fly line is simply taking in the slack fly line after we make those little flutters and bumps. Does that make sense?
Sure, yeah, makes perfect sense. Yeah, good tip.
We're using that stripping hand to strip that streamer. We're more using that rod tip to kind of flutter and bump that streamer, if you will.
Yeah, good. Let's take a quick break, and then we'll talk more about strategies and tactics here for both the trout and the carp. So hang tight, folks. Royal Gorge Anglers is a full-service fly shop on the Arkansas River in Canyon City, Colorado. They provide both walk, wade, and float fishing guide service on the Arkansas, South Platte, and several private high country ranches. They specialize in fly fishing education and work to assure that everyone taking a trip leaves being a better fly fisher. For the best service and the most fun in the Southern Rockies, visit the folks at Royal Gorge Anglers, the gateway to Southern Colorado. Located conveniently on US 50, only 45 minutes from Colorado Springs. For more information, visit their website at www.royalgorgeanglers.com. That's www.royalgorgeanglers.com or call them at 888-994-6743. That's 888-994-6743. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We're talking with Kirk Webb about the fishing the lower Colorado River for trout and carp. If you'd like to ask Kirk a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Okay, let's kind of continue on with some tactics and strategies for trout, and then we'll flip over for the last section and talk about carp. Does that make kind of sense? Okay.
Absolutely.
All right, so given the character, now you talked about the river up in Glenwood Canyon, which is more of a canyon style, you know, rougher, probably more, free fall rocks and so forth in that canyon fishing.
Correct.
Once we get down from Glenwood and we get in the bigger river, are there different strategies or techniques you use to find fish? Sometimes I know a lot of people just like lakes, sometimes big rivers intimidate them because they don't know where to go. Where do you look for the fish?
The best way for me to explain it to people, Roger, is to take a large section of the river, like the Colorado, and I always try and break it down into little quadrants. I try and take that big water and just minimize it. I try and pick out all those little pieces of structure, that will hold those fish. It's something you really almost have to develop an eye for. I think the Colorado is a little bit unique, too, in the fact that a lot of the fish have a tendency to suspend. We don't necessarily see a lot of fish eating on the surface, although we certainly do at times. But it should also be noted that we don't necessarily just dredge the bottom like we do on many other tailwaters and smaller freestone rivers. These fish really have an affinity to suspend. Because of that, either, dry dropper type rigs are very effective in the warmer months, where in the colder months, those fish still hold, again, relatively close to the bank, so we don't have to do any long line nymphing. A lot of the nymph fishing we're doing is very much short line nymph fishing, where even my distance from my indicator to my split shot above my flies might be only, 2.5 to 3 feet at times. Mm. So it really does widely vary.
Okay. And that right there is a great tip of not fishing so deep, because you're fishing right, generally trying to fish those shells or just off those shells. Is that a common area for them to suspend?
It is typically a very common area. Obviously, I think like trout fishing anywhere, the biggest key, especially for myself, is oftentimes just to sit down and watch. I don't think a lot of fishermen spend enough time sitting and watching and, learning to what the river's trying to tell you if you kind of listen and watch close enough. I think there's a lot to be said for sitting on your butt that you don't really see a lot of anglers do these days.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I think I learn more at times almost from just sitting down and letting things happen and instead of trying to make things happen.
Yeah. I've heard that so many times from guides. But then again, many times the guides, that's what they're doing. They're guiding,
Right.
Because you're not preoccupied with fishing. you're scouting, you're looking, you're seeing, and so you guys have that advantage of practicing that all the time. Whereas many of us others, we go to a new place and we only have 3 days and we've got to cram in all the fishing, and it just doesn't seem like sitting on the bank, is what we want to be doing. We're too excited, you know what I mean?
Exactly like what you said. Even when I go to a new piece of water and I can afford to do so, I certainly always hire a local guide, at least for that first day or two, at least to get the lay of the land and learn all the local techniques and hatches and, really pick apart that guide's brain. That way I can go out there by myself without a guide and kind of do those same things that I was taught. And You know, again, I'm at a huge advantage in the fact that we have 30 guides that work for us at Taylor Creek, and I have all this information constantly coming in and feeding into me throughout the course of every day throughout the entire year. So I kind of get a very unique perspective on the river that I think a lot of others aren't fortunate enough to have. And, you said, certainly the way to cut down that learning curve is to hire a good local guide.
Yeah, yeah. What other tactics can you give us some tips on for trout? We talked about that kind of shallow water nymphing. Anything else that you can share with us?
I'd say maybe the biggest tip, you know, and this is one that you'll hear, you know, our guides reiterate often, is that none of us like to fish the lower Colorado River post cold front. When a cold front comes through, for whatever reason, the fishing on that particular section of river really does just shut down for a day or two. You know, I think it's also a little bit more affected, again, by weather and rain, you know, again, because it's the Colorado and it does have so many of those little fingers and tributaries. But yeah, you know, it's a very fickle river. It's a river that will kick your butt one day and give you your best day of fishing that you've had the next. And it really is a temperamental river. I tell people, don't get frustrated if you go out there one day and have a slow day. It happens, and it happens fairly frequently on this section of river, especially to most novice fishermen, you know. But I can tell you from personal experience, if you stick with it long enough and the river slowly kind of begins to unlock those secrets for you, you begin to get things wired and be able to, you know, have a few spots in the palm of your hand that you'll be able to go to that you know are, you know, more consistent than other places and times of year and times of day and things like that. But again, you know, I think for the novice angler, going to our website, taylorcreek.com, and clicking on those river reports links, they're updated a few times a week. They're written by myself and a lot of the other good guides and shop employees that we have, and they're always up to date and give you the best information on where to go, what to use, any special techniques, and local fly patterns.
Okay. A couple questions came in here on the Internet. Lanford, Pritchett, and Castle Rock. He says, in nymphing for the suspended fish, what distance do you suggest between the split and the fly?
You know, again, Roger, that's where, you know, us as a guide, and myself as a guide, you know, being able to reach that water and see at what depth those fish are suspending is key. You know, you must have a good pair of polarized sunglasses to peer into that water to see those suspended fish that sometimes might be holding 6 inches below the surface and at other times might be holding 4 feet below the surface. You know, again, there's so many variables involved in weather, light conditions, river conditions, water clarity, time of day, time of year that's going to dictate where those fish suspend. So because of that, it's hard for me to give an exact answer. But again, I tell you, you know, you really have to use your eyes on this river to figure out at what level those fish are suspending. In general, I would say maybe start at about that 3-foot mark from indicator to split shot. But again, let the fish tell you where that depth needs to be.
Okay, okay. And another question from Mark in New London. As the Colorado spreads out below Glenwood Springs, what are the opportunities for two-handed fishing for trout, streamers, wets, and even nymphing?
You know, a lot, tremendously so. You know, obviously it's one of the larger rivers that we have in the state, actually for the country for that matter. And, it's big, wide open water. You can certainly take a two-handed rod or even a switch rod out there and expect to do well. You know, I think it's a matter of personal preference. It's almost like a tank or a fishing on the opposite side of the spectrum. It's personally not my gig, but I have many friends and many guide friends that do two-hand fish the Colorado religiously. It's, again, I'd tell you more of a indicator skagit-type fishery in the way of two-hand fishing, but, you know, there can be times when swinging streamers is highly effective with the two-hand rod. Again, just a matter of personal preference. It's not mine, but I'm glad it's his.
Yeah, yeah, okay. And here's kind of a transition question to start talking about carp in our last few minutes. Phil McCartney wrote in, he says, do carp and trout actually occupy the same water, or are the carp typically in warmer stretches of water while trout would, where trout would not do well?
Typically, they don't really intermix that often. There's certainly zones of that river where you do get that little cross-section where both are thriving together. But for the most part, the carp are in one part of the river, the trout are in another. Again, I'd tell you, east of Rifle is that trout fishery section, where west of Rifle turns into more of that carp fishery.
Okay, okay. Let's talk about strategies and tactics for carp then. Danny Buchanan from Lake Tahoe, California, wrote in and said, is targeting river carp different than lake carp?
Good question. It is a little bit different, but not much, or at least in the section of river that I fish on the lower Colorado. You're fishing so many back channels and side channels and big eddies that, you know, there really is very little, if much, in the way of moving water. And because of that, it is much more like fishing a still water, like a lake or a reservoir or something like that. There are times of year, i.e. the high bright sun and dog days of August, when those carp will even move out more into the river and into the riffles where the water is a little bit more oxygenated. And, you know, I can't say they're going to differ much outside of the fact we might have to lead or cast in front of those river fish a little bit further just to allow our fly to get down to that carp's level. But in general, I'd tell you, they both cross over very well, very similar.
Okay. Where do you look for carp in the lower stretches there? Are they in different places than you would look for trout? How do you change up your, you know, your scouting?
They certainly are. You know, again, they're more in those back channels and back eddies and more stagnant, slower-moving pieces of the river down here. You know, a lot like looking for suspended trout, you know, I'm also relying on my eyes almost exclusively to carp fish the lower Colorado. You know, again, for me, I think my love of carp fishing is the hunt and the fact that, you know, you do get to see and stalk your quarry, and, you know, that's always been kind of my allure to it. So I guess I'm using my eyes more than anything in the way of where those carp are. You know, carp are kind of funny. They're a very adaptable fish to a wide variety of conditions, and they can handle some of that swifter, deeper water as well as they can a lot of that soft and stagnant water. Again, for my personal fishing, I enjoy that hunt, so I like more of the shallow water sight fishing aspect and game of it. And because of that, I'm more relying on my eyes more so than reading the water per se.
Yeah, that was you basically answered, I think, Roy Fukushima's question about the sight cast for carp in slow-moving clear water. So do you ever fish for carp without seeing them? Is it always a sight fishing affair?
Yes and no. I'm always looking for carp. That doesn't mean we're necessarily seeing carp. Oftentimes, if carp are schooling, especially, and a lot of those fish are even mudding on the bottom, creating a lot of disturbance and little mud puffs on the bottom, which would make me not be able to see those fish specifically, but I can see those puffs of mud that are covering up the carp. So even when I'm not looking at carp, I'm still searching for carp. Does that make sense, Roger?
Sure, sure. It's kind of like, you know, when you're out on the ocean and you see birds going after baitfish, you know.
Exactly. Much
you head over to that part of the ocean, you know, because there's something happening there. What are there other things that are telltale signs that, beyond little mud puffs that carp leave?
You know, I think the cool thing for me living so far inland and away from the oceans is it's the carp share so many of the best sporting qualities of the best game fish. And in my eyes, it's probably closest to anything to a redfish, but it certainly has a lot of those more tarpon-like characteristics too, where we've kind of given all these fish kind of terms, if you will, of sunning fish or mudding fish or laid-up fish, much the same terms and analogies that saltwater fly fishermen use for tarpon and redfish.
So you may see the same kind of activities then. What about tailing? Do you see tailing carp?
Definitely have tailing carp as well. You know, obviously that's limited to very shallow, flat pieces of water that are small enough to enable a carp tail to even be seen. But, yes, there are certainly times when huge numbers of carp can be seen tailing. But I wouldn't say that's typical. You know, which is one of the things I love about fishing for carp is that they're anything but typical. Their behavior changes frequently, and it even changes from fish to fish, you know, within the same piece of water. You could have one fish that's tailing. You could have another fish that's just kind of sunbasking 10 feet away. You know, a lot of the best carp anglers are always able to decide which carp are the hungry carp, you know, being able to read the carp, being able to read the bodily signals that those carp are sending off that are telling you if that fish is an actively feeding fish or an inactively feeding fish. And oftentimes it's hard to decipher between the two, but I think, you know, that again, that's that character trait that I think the best of the best of many anglers have is being able to find not just fish, but the feeding fish. Much goes the same for carp.
Carp can be very finicky, right, about their feeding, maybe more so than trout?
No doubt about it. I would say much more so than trout.
So can you give us some tips on you know, getting them interested? I mean, if you're putting – I guess this combines with what you just said. You know, you're not going to catch a carp that's not feeding. I mean, it's just – kind of a lost effort there. But are there any tactics that work to, you know, try to entice them or get them on the feed? And, you know, what do you do when you're not getting any hits? What tactics do you do?
No, I'm glad you asked, Roger. And it kind of brings us back again a little bit here in that I think one of the best tactics I have to be successful in carp fishing is what my friends and I, what we like to call storking, you know, which is just really waiting silently and patiently, just watching the river, kind of letting those fish come to you instead of you trying to find the fish, you know, just being able to sit patient like a stork would, you know, waiting for that quarry to kind of come in, slip up, and, you know, is when you can get in there and get your shot, if you will. So, yeah. I think that's kind of the best way to go about doing it. A lot of fly fishermen, I think especially for carp, get hung up on fly pattern. In my experience, it's always better off to, you know, just read the fish, you know, being able to tell if that fish is feeding or not feeding, and then throwing a fly, regardless of, you know, necessarily what it is, at that fish. It's kind of goes back to having the right lure in the wrong place isn't necessarily better than having the wrong lure in the right place.
Okay. One more question here. Lanford just wrote in from Castle Rock again. Thanks for asking questions, Lanford. He says, and if you will carry this question forward, and that's how we'll end the night here. Lanford says, if you were to pump a carp's stomach, what would you find, a.k.a. would they be feeding on what the trout don't in the same water? What would they be feeding on? And then why don't you just share with us a couple of your favorite patterns for the carp?
Sure. you know, again, I think fly pattern wise, most of my flies I tie myself. They're not commercially available patterns. Again, I think one of the reasons I love fly fishing is because it does make you a little bit more in tune with the sport, and obviously fly tying makes you even that much more in tune with the sport. And I've always kind of got a kick out of being able to catch fish on my own flies, not necessarily those that are commercially available. But I think for carp anglers looking for flies that are commercially available, both Umpqua Feather Merchants as well as Solitude have, and Rainies all have a tremendous carp flies. I think it's of more importance to note that you would want a variety of carp flies in different weights. I would want to have a few flies that would float, a few flies that would sink very slowly, a few flies that would sink faster, and some that would sink very fast. In the way of size and colorations, I think most carp typically like more neutral-oriented colors. I don't do anything too gaudy, nothing flashy. I try to stay more subtle in my flies, but flies that incorporate a lot of movement. I'm a big, big fan of marabou because of that, because of its movement and its lightness. But should be noted, I also like carrying carp flies that land soft. You know, I don't want a carp fly that lands with a hard crash or splash on the water. You know, I definitely want my flies to land as soft as possible to not stalk those carp, or spook those carp, rather.
Okay, okay. And to his question about what would you find in their stomach if you pumped it?
You know, carp are the ultimate adaptable fish. You know, you can find anything and everything in a carp, and that's kind of our joke, you know, amongst all my carp fishing buddies, is there are times when carp are seemingly eating anything and everything under the sun, but yet there are also those times when, you know, it doesn't matter what you have on, you can't catch a carp to save your life. You know, it's hard for me to say. It widely varies. You know, I think just experience in the field is, you know, there's no substitute for that. You know, no matter what, how much you can read online and fill your head with all this great carp fishing info, you're really just, you have to get out onto the water and do it and learn it. And, you know, that'll make you a more adept carp fisherman more than anything. I think I too am a very analytical fisherman, and I like to read a lot, and I like a lot of history and, you know, all that type of stuff. But at some point, I think you kind of have to pick off those good things, get rid of all the bad, and kind of mash them together to make your own. But again, just no real substitute for time spent in the field. And, you know, I'm privileged enough that I have a lot of time, and I get paid to spend time in the field. And I know other anglers aren't that lucky, but certainly utilize anglers like me for that help.
There you go. There you go. Well, on that note, we'll have to wrap things up here. We're over time, but stick with me for a few more minutes, folks. We're going to be giving away that membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers, a one-year subscription to Fly Fishing and Tying Journal, and also a dozen of Kirk's favorite flies for the Colorado River, courtesy of Taylor Creek Fly Shop. So stick with us just a couple more minutes. A mining company called Pac Rim Coal is planning a massive strip mine near Anchorage, Alaska. The Chewitna Coal Project would be the first project in Alaska history to mine directly through salmon habitat, the Chewitna River drainage, 11 miles of it. Critical commercial, sport, and subsistence fishing economies would be permanently destroyed. Pac Rim says it can rebuild a salmon stream, but scientific experts can find no example where successful restoration has occurred after strip mining. Chewitna coal would be shipped to Alaska, leaving Alaska with nothing but devastated habitat. Leaving Alaska with nothing but devastated habitat and ruined salmon runs. It's time to stop the Chewitna coal strip mine. For more information about how you can help, just go to www.inletkeeper.org, inletkeeper.org. Just a quick reminder to everyone, before you leave the website tonight, please take a minute and give us your feedback about the show. You can find a link on our homepage in the section under tonight's show that says, what did you think of the show? Just click on that link, leave us your comments. We'd really appreciate it. Well, now it's time to give away a few prizes. Winners for tonight's drawing are randomly selected from the show's registration database. If you didn't register for the show tonight, it's too late now, but make sure you do so for our next show so you don't miss out on some of these great prizes. If you are the lucky winner, we'll contact you after the show by email and ask for information from you to be able to send you the prize. So, let's see here. First, we'll give away the one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers. If you want to learn more about the Federation, go to fedflyfishers.org, fedflyfishers.org, a great organization to support and be part of. And let's see what my database says. My winner here is Geraldo Vittergaard in Idaho. So Geraldo, I'm having trouble saying that. Sorry. Congratulations on winning the membership to the Federation. So we'll contact you shortly about how you get to become a member of that. Our second prize we're going to give away is a one-year subscription to the Fly Fishing and Tying Journal, courtesy of Amato Books. And to find out more about Amato Books and what they have to offer in both books and periodicals is AmatoBooks.com, AmatoBooks.com. And our winner there is, let's see here, Rob Konowich in Pennsylvania. So congratulations, Rob. And I know you'll enjoy that publication. Okay, now we're going to give away a dozen of Kirk's favorite flies. We're going to have to, let's see here, clear our queue. And the question is, can be a very easy one. Kirk mentioned that the carp was very similar to another sport fish that a lot of us fish for that doesn't live in Colorado. What fish is that? So let's see. And we've got waiting for the fast typers here, Kirk, so we'll see what we get here.
No problem. Someone's going to be awfully lucky.
They have to be pay attention. Okay, Dean Wormell and Westford, Massachusetts. He says redfish. Would that be the correct answer then?
That is the correct answer.
Okay, good. Well, Dean is the one before. He's very astute and pays attention and is a fast typer. So, Joe Herndon, you missed that by, let's see, 1 second.
Wow.
Dean, it gives me the timing here. Dean beat you by 1 second. Sorry, buddy. But anyway, try again next time. And anyway, congratulations, Dean. Send me again your address so I can pass that on over to Kirk. You know the routine, I think, by now. So send it on over to me, and we'll get you taken care of. Okay. Well, Kirk, hey, we appreciate you being with us. It was great to have you on the show and talk with you about a piece of water I didn't know much about, and now I know quite a bit more about. So thanks for taking time and sharing your experience and knowledge with us.
It was a tremendous amount of fun. My blood's even running just from talking, Kirk. I'm excited.
Ready to go fishing, huh?
I am.
Well, there's always night fishing down by the baseball fields. Remember that. And I saw some people, some kids at high school practicing baseball already. Can time of year in Colorado, so it's not that far away. So
that's
we
right.
Like to play baseball in the snow here in Colorado for some reason. I don't know, but anyway. All righty. Well, hopefully you all have found the archive on our website. If you haven't, there's a couple of links on the homepage and at the links on the bottom of every page. We've done over 200 shows now. So search around, use keyword phrases like fish, rivers, lakes, that kind of thing, techniques, and see what you can find. There's just a wealth of information out there. Our next broadcast will be on February 18th, and on that show I'll interview Matt Austin and Corey Bentassi. And our topic for the show will be carp on the fly Southern California style. So Matt and Corey are professional guides out of La Jolla, California, and they're going to take us on a search for carp in the lakes and streams in Southern California. So join us to find out how they catch carp California style. We'd also like to thank the Federation of Fly Fishers, Amato Books, Front Range Anglers, Taylor Creek Fly Shop, and Women's Fly Fishing in Alaska, Royal Gorge Anglers, and Keeney's Fly Shop for sponsoring our show tonight. If you think your company would benefit from sponsoring one of our shows, give us a call, 1-800-985-1673, and we'll be happy to explain the options available to you. Don't forget to visit our website, askaboutflyfishing.com, and make sure you're signed up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Thanks for listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We hope you enjoyed the show. That's it. Good night, everyone, and good fishing.